Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to this episode number 93 of the Free Cities Podcast. Well, this week, once again, I've been experimenting with AI to write these intros, and to be honest, once again, it's pretty good. It's not done half bad at all. I'll give you a little lowdown on the episode in quotes. In this conversation, the speakers discuss various topics related to Bitcoin, including the installation of miners in an off-grid truck, their experiences living self-sovereign lives during the COVID-19 pandemic, and the potential of decentralized networks like Nostr to revolutionize digital identity. They also explore the connections between time, entropy, and Bitcoin, and discuss the current state of Bitcoin adoption and infrastructure globally, emphasizing the importance of collaboration and merchant onboarding for further growth. That's pretty much what happened. And my guest is Nathan Day, a fellow Brit. He's a former global IT systems optimizer who managed to gain a degree of financial freedom when he sold his company a few years ago, leading to him and his wife asking themselves the question, and this is in quotes as well, if you were terminally ill and had 2 years to live, what would we do? Well, for them, the answer came in the form of a custom-built, fully pimped-out overland truck, which their family's been using as a home from home ever since. I've been in it, believe me. It's very cool indeed. If you're a Bitcoiner, then you'll probably know Nathan better as the co-founder of BTC Map, which is an app for finding merchants that accept Bitcoin all over the world. Now, because Nathan's involved in that project, he has access to some very interesting information and shares some fascinating insights into merchant adoption around the globe, which I would say is arguably one of the best metrics for measuring the success of Bitcoin in general. So listen on for that, and thanks to Nathan for popping in to see us. Always a pleasure, mate. Anyway, links in the show notes for everything you'll need to know about BTC Map, Nathan, and the Free Cities movement. And thanks again for all the streaming sats. They are very highly appreciated. Shout out to Fountain App for their excellent platform. And a very appreciative shout out to all our listeners. Thank you for listening. Keep building and spreading the good word. In my opinion, there is no finish line. There is just the journey. However, you do, of course, get to relax along the way. In fact, right now, you could really just sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Nathan Day. Let's go back to what we were talking about just before we left.
Yeah.
So I'll set the scene, because you've got like the best overland vehicle that I think I've ever seen in real life anyway, short of passing by something in America on the freeway and going, wow, look at that.
Yeah.
You've basically got a sort of custom off-road, I mean, you could describe it. It's just a massive truck.
Yeah, Overlander, they're called, yeah.
Right, okay. The kind of thing people drive to India in.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. You've got your own one, and you take your family all over the place in it, and it's just awesome. But you were telling me here on the way that you've installed Bitcoin miners into it.
Right.
Right. I've got a couple of questions straight away, obviously. One is, how the hell do you power? Mm-hmm. Bitcoin miners are notoriously power hungry.
Yeah.
And so I don't think batteries... Obviously, what is it, the engine of the truck, or is it...
Well, we can get into it for sure.
Go on then, tell me how it works.
Okay, so yeah, the truck has got an off-grid system that's built into it. And so we've got 600 watt of solar on the roof. We've got 10 kilowatt hours of lithium batteries.
10 kilowatt hours. What was that like? What's a Tesla battery in your house, for example? You know, one of those big ones?
Yes, they're probably bigger. I don't know. So a kilowatt hour would mean you could probably run a kettle for an hour.
Right.
And kettles are fairly energy intensive, or maybe for half an hour or so. So yeah, you've got sort of 10 of those.
10 kilowatt hour. So wait a minute, let me just this in straight. When you have a kilowatt hour of something, does that mean if it's full, you can run it for 10 hours at a kilowatt? Without, you know, like, whatever.
Exactly.
1,000 watt machine
yeah.
will run for 10 hours on that one battery.
Yeah, or if it was 10 kilowatts, you could have an hour's worth of...
A larger thing.
Yeah.
Okay, exactly. Right, cool.
Yeah. So, yeah, basically, I wouldn't say they're huge batteries, but they're certainly bigger than a normal camper van. Because the truck is an 8-ton truck, you've got more... capacity to put stuff on it, and that goes for not just power, water. So we've got almost 250 liters of water on board that goes through various filtration systems. So we've got dual particle filters plus UV light filter, so we can actually pump water out of the lake effectively and safely drink that.
Wow.
So yeah, anyway, we're set up to be off grid. And when we first started traveling, I mean, that was pre-Bitcoin for me. So I hadn't looked at Bitcoin, obviously, and dismissed it as a, you know, Ponzi scam and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it wasn't part of the config of the truck when we had it built, but it very recently got into it. And as you say, you know, Bitcoin mining, is very energy intensive. And the Bitcoin miners that are produced by the likes of Bitmain and the, you know, with their Antminers and stuff, they are targeted at industrial use. And so they run at like 2.5 kilowatts. So I could plug that into the truck, but we'd be empty very quickly, and it'd get very hot very quickly, and nobody would be sleeping because it's very noisy. And so they are meant for data centers. And so there's a couple of projects now that are now focused on kind of pleb mining. And the one that I've been involved with, as in from a user perspective and just started to get involved in the community now, is the Bitax. So a guy called Scott out of the US is running that project, and I think he's just got some OpenSats funding to kind of pursue that as his main activity. So he's quit fiat mining and he's now doing this. So the thing with the Bitax is, rather than on say like a S21 miner or a S19 or S9 or whatever, you've probably got, depending on the model, between 2 and 3 or sometimes 400 individual ASICs, which are the actual chips on the board, right? And they're very power hungry and very noisy, as we've just said. So what the Bitax does, it takes a single, the one I've got is a single S21 ASIC, little chip, on a single board. So that takes maximum 20 watts of power to hash very efficiently, because it's the S21 chip, which was only released, I think, 6 months ago. You can't even buy them new anymore. So what the guys are doing when they're creating these Bitaxes is they're buying brand new S21 miners, and they're not even plugging them in. They're taking the soldering irons and they're taking the S21 chips off these things. And what the Bitax project have done is they've reverse engineered the Bitmain basically chips, so that they can now drive those chips, and it's fully open source. So yeah, I've got a handful of Bitaxes.
Where do they come in? Is it a little box or something?
Yes, they're literally this big.
3 inches by 3 inches.
Yeah, and you can 3D print cases for them. So it's all part of the maker community, which again is awesome.
Have you ever found any blocks with it?
Oh, you're in a pool, I take it.
In a pool, yeah. Right. I mean,
imagine if you just...
You can solo mine with them, and a lot of people do. And I forget the stat exactly, but it's not dissimilar to entering the California State Lottery in terms of the cost and the outcome.
That's right? A good way of looking at it.
So yeah, rather than buy your lottery ticket every day, you just keep the miner on.
Installing Bitcoin miners in your live-in vehicle, right?
Yeah.
Have you done that? Is there any kind of economic point to that? Or is it purely just so you can do it?
It's mainly just because I can do it, and it's nice messing around with it. The Bitcoin mining side was my latest part of the Bitcoin rabbit hole that I went down because I didn't really understand it fully. And the best way I learn is to just go and try it and, make mistakes and learn that way. And I was also getting concerned around some of the conversations around block template production and mining pool centralization and things like that. So it helped me understand all of that world. But yeah, so back to the Bitaxes then. So the other good thing is their native DC power. And so when you buy them, obviously you get an AC adapter to plug them into your wall socket at home. But they're 5-volt DC.
Straight into the van.
And we operate natively DC in the van. So we do have an inverter, which means we can get AC power for regular appliances, but we're 24 volts native. So yeah, a few step downs down to 5. And yeah, we've got this distribution panel.
Will it ever pay for itself?
Over enough time it will, because the power is free.
Oh, it's coming out of the alternator of the truck, you mean?
Well, two things. So when we're traveling, the alternator is charging the batteries, and we get about, 1,500 watts that way. And also we've got the 600 watts coming from the sun. And so when we're traveling around and it's sunny, we've got infinite power effectively.
You're mining Bitcoin.
And we're mining Bitcoin.
That's nice.
Philosophically, we are decentralizing mining. And I know it doesn't matter because I've got close to 2 terahash, which is absolutely nothing. Like, I mean, in the pool, it gets me maybe 500 sats a day or something. So, it's nobody's retiring off of this. But it just feels good that you're hashing when you're...
Especially when you're parked.
Yeah.
When you're parked, earning 500 sacks a day. Yeah. One day, you might look back and go, how funny, we were earning $500 a day parked. Oh. It's a thought experiment, but
it is.
It is fun. To tell you what, Nathan, why don't you explain where your past that's brought you to this point? Because,
how far back you want to go?
just the business side of things, the software-y, any of that,
Yeah, okay. So I guess, coming out of uni, so I did physics. I'm a kind of science nerd, really got into the physics side of stuff through university, and that kind of got me into software. I was working in... global IT system integrator stuff, straight out of uni, grad scheme stuff. And I never really fitted in that environment to the point where I kind of got in trouble a lot because I just didn't respect any of the rules of how you're supposed to act and behave and even dress. And, it was far too constraining, actually, in hindsight. I didn't know that at the time, but... But yes, that effectively threw me out into starting my own business, which I started with a couple of friends. And we were doing some fairly serious IT systems. So optimizing airports, how you get the aircraft to the departing runway in the order in which they need to depart. And as you probably understand, the airport is a massive, complex moving system. So you probably call it like AI and stuff now, but back then we were just solving problems. So optimizing airports and airspace, and we did some work with telcos and railway operators to make fixed infrastructure more efficient, because you can't just build a new runway or put a new frame line in somewhere, right? So if you can get an extra 2% efficiency out of Heathrow Airport, then that's valuable to them. So yeah, we did that. We saw that business. We built it up over 10 years. We got to, like, I think 65 people or something like that. And that was bloody hard work. So yeah, just completely all encompassing, really. But then, yeah, we got an exit that we weren't particularly looking for, but an opportunity presented itself and we took it. And that bought us kind of some element of financial freedom. So it wasn't like, you know, never work again money, like go and buy a yacht or whatever. It was enough just to take the edge off life, really.
You did go and buy something quite expensive.
We kind of bought a land yacht, I guess, in the yeah, Overlander exactly. truck. Yeah, maybe with a few less zeros on than a...
But that whole going and buying, building an Overlander truck, right? Yeah. When did the whole, I call that like self-sovereign life, isn't it? It's like, when had that already started? Like, were you already a bit of a traveller, a bit of a...
Yeah, we travelled all over the place growing up. And in fact, when I was a kid, I was probably 8 or 9. Yeah, about 8, I guess. We had bought an old Bedford ambulance and drove it to Yugoslavia one summer. So, like, I think...
You as in your family?
As in the family, wow. Yeah. And that was kind of a DIY conversion. Not that my Overlander was DIY, but, yeah, I think those sorts of early experiences make sure that, you know, you've got a different perspective on where the boundaries of what's possible are. And so, yeah, we got a kind of early sense of travel freedom through things like that, I guess.
And what was the intention behind building this monster of a device?
Well, we love travel. We wanted to escape, I guess, really. Me and my wife, I remember we went on a walk because we were like, okay, well, what do we do now? And I remember we asked ourselves a question. If we were terminally ill and we had 2 years to live, what would we do? And the answer was we'd go and travel the world, and we'd like to do that in a truck. We'd had a motorhome prior to that, so we kind of got, you know, a lay of the land, really. And so, yeah, we're like, okay, YOLO, let's go build a truck and drive east.
As succinctly as possible, tell me what it is.
Okay, so Overlander truck is basically a camper van on steroids, really. So a lot of the motorhomes you see are limited by weight because of the license that you have. So they're all mostly under 3,500 kilos. And therefore, things are a little bit tacky and a bit breaky, and you can't carry much in terms of water and batteries and all that kind of stuff. And they're on fairly flimsy frames, so you're talking like a Fiat Ducato or whatever.
That's what we had.
Yeah,
we had a Hymer.
Yeah,
I thought they
Hymers
were pretty good.
Actually. Yeah. The old school ones.
Yeah.
Whereas this is a truck, so it's a different beast from the ground up. So it's on a steel C-frame, effectively, and we've got a Mercedes Vario from 2006. They don't make them anymore.
It looks like an army truck. What were they used for in the real world?
They were used on building sites, and they were used mine in particular was a municipal vehicle in a German town. So, like, they were putting Christmas trees up, and they used as dumper trucks sometimes and things like that. So, yeah, so the Vario that we've got, it's permanent 4x4. It's got fixed differentials, so you can lock out if you get stuck, which we often do. And yeah, low range gearbox and things like that. So it means that you can get where you need to get. And yeah, because it's rated up to 8 tons, it means you can actually put decent gear in. And a lot of the stuff in there is marine grade equipment. So it's meant to be, you know, used.
Is it completely custom?
It is.
Do you go somewhere? I mean, do people make them, or do you have to go and literally specify to someone that I want this?
Yeah, there are makers. So we had ours built by a company called Twiga Travel Cars in the Netherlands. It tends to be the Germans, the Dutch, Austrians that specialize it. There's a couple of in the UK that do it, but kind of it's not commonplace. Yeah.
And the fact that it's like as like a proper off-roader. How important was that? Where were you planning on going where you thought you needed all that?
We did go down to Patagonia. So we did a European leg, so up through Scandinavia and then all the way down through Europe to North Africa, Morocco. And then we shipped out into Uruguay to Montevideo.
What does that mean? Putting it on a...
Yeah, put it on, they call it, well, a roll-on, roll-off ship.
Oh, right. You drive onto it.
You drop it at the port. They take it from the port. You can't go on the ship. It's not like a passenger ferry.
So you have
ferry.
To fly over.
You fly over. Right. So it took about a month to get out to Montevideo. And then, yeah, we went through Argentina you kind of zip between Chile and Argentina as you go through Patagonia. You have to do that like 5 or 6 times. That's just the way.
What was happening in Argentina when you went through? Was any of the financial troubles happening?
Oh, they've had financial troubles for 30 years.
But the serious stuff. When was the really serious hyperinflation? It was 2000.
It was after the serious stuff. So when was this? It was 2019 maybe. Yeah, 2019, 2020. But yeah, when we were in Argentina, we were queuing up at Western Unions because they had the blue dollar and the kind of official rate. And we were getting backpacks full of currency in Western Union.
Jesus.
Because that was the only way to do it. Because you couldn't use the ATMs because they had crazy fees on them. You got a better rate by something like 25% via Western Union.
And how long did you have to spend that before it was just like chucking away?
Yeah, so it wasn't in... we weren't experiencing price inflation at that time that was noticeable day by day. And now, of course, year by year, it adds up. But yeah, and for me, that was pre-Bitcoin. So... I'd like to do it again through a kind of Bitcoiner lens, actually.
It sounds like people are using stable coins a lot at the moment. I think that might be the strategy at the moment, at least.
Yeah, so there's a lot of USDT activity. But we're also seeing a growth in merchant adoption down there. I guess we'll get onto BTC maps in a bit. But right now we're seeing a lot of merchant adoption in Argentina and Brazil. They're the kind of two countries that we've seen.
Yeah, before we get onto the map stuff, let's stick on the
self-sovereign
life. Did you have a long game you were playing there, or was it like, let's just drive around until we get bored and then come over?
Yeah, that was pretty much it at that time. But then I think you just get used to the freedom. And then you layer COVID on top of this. So we got stuck down in Chile when COVID hit. So we've been out of the news bubble totally. We weren't part of any of that. We were just living our sovereign life on the road and homeschooling the kids and doing all that good stuff. And then when we were down in Patagonia, we'd heard there was the ferries down to Antarctica were cheaper than usual. Not the ferries, the cruise that they do.
Down to Antarctica?
Yeah, you can get them from the bottom of
Patagonia, sure.
Ushuaia, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because all of the Asian visitors had been banned or
stopped coming in.
And we're like, oh, what's going on? And people are talking about this flu thing. And we're like, oh, well, there's been loads of those before. Yeah, no biggie, whatever. And then we were traveling up through Chile. We just left, thankfully, actually, Argentina. I'll come back to Hawaii in a minute. And then we entered Chile, and then literally the next day, everything closed down in Chile. Borders closed, everything stopped. But we managed to just absolute luck stop on this kind of like homestay small holding with a American Argentinian family that ran the place, and then another family from Serbia, actually, and Croat Serbs they were. And so we were locked down on this wonderful sort of place near Santiago in Chile. And we just rode COVID out there. And the kids were not wearing masks. They were not confined inside. We were on our own land. There was a river coming through the land. The kids were just having the sort of childhood that we had, running around and only coming home, well, back to the truck as it was, when they were hungry or injured. That was, you know, we do some homeschooling in the morning and that was it. We wouldn't see them for hours. So actually looking back, that was one of the highlights of our trip.
Well, it's also, when you think about it, you really did, you tested the thesis out and it worked.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not being funny, but if you're talking about being self-sovereign, you really need to be mobile as well. You can't, being self-sovereign on a farm is one thing.
Yeah.
But being self-sovereign mobile, that's pretty much the kind of, like, unless it's a boat.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, you still have limitations. So we couldn't leave Chile because, well, we couldn't even drive out of the front gates because of the lockdowns. But we were in this imaginary bubble thing where we weren't affected by everything that was happening. And we could see what was happening at home. And so, you know, basically Western democracies lost their minds and locked people up in their houses. And so we were getting very worried phone calls from friends and family saying, oh, you know, you must come home and stuff. I'm like, well, why would do that?
Why? I thought, what was the reason? Yeah. Why would they want you to come home? What?
Oh, just, you know, familiarity, isn't it? You're stuck in Chile and the healthcare system there is, you know, not what it is here.
Oh,
and stuff,
right.
And all of that stuff.
But it's a mindset thing, isn't it? I mean, you either think of your home as home or you think of the world as a series of places that you can use to your advantage, you know, flag theory type thing. Yeah. You know, like, it's a real mindset.
And that's part of the reason we got the vehicle, the truck to travel in, because we were homeschooling the kids as well, we wanted some sense of familiarity. And so when we had the truck, that was the home. And it just happened that the home could move. So it's kind of like the best of both worlds, really.
Do you get into van life?
Hashtag van life.
Did you get into it when you were there? Did you meet a lot of other van lifers and stuff?
Yeah, we did. And quite a lot of other traveling families as well, because we were hooked into the whole world school sort of scene as well. And yeah, we were meeting other kind of freedom orientated people, because it's highly self-selective. So I remember we met this Polish family living in Germany, but Polish guys in a car park in the Arsenda of Patagonia. Two kids, truck similar to ours. So already, you know, you've got a number of ticks there. So, and we got on great. And so, yeah, you know, it's a self-selecting group of people.
I can't believe you met someone else with a truck like yours. How common are those trucks? They're ginormous, great things.
Yeah, not too common. But the places where you take them, again, it's a self-selecting thing. So people with overlanders tend to go and drive to the end of the earth down in Patagonia. And not go, you know, camping in Wales for the weekend or whatever.
I mean, in Patagonia, for example, is it like total freedom? Because I know what that place is like. Can you just drive wherever you want
vast.
And just stay there?
Yes, pretty much. But you've got to be prepared, because at the time we had a range, I think, of about 750 kilometers with the fuel situation we had. We've now upgraded our tank, so we've got almost double that now. But in planning the route, we had to carry additional jerry cans of diesel on the roof. Another, what was it now? I think another 300 litres we had up on the roof. And we needed to use that in order to get between the gas stations down there. Mm.
I had the same thing up in the Himalayas. Yeah. I had a Royal Enfield. I rode it all around the Himalayas. But I had to carry, instead of panniers, we had to carry more fuel. Yeah. Yeah. But if you wanted to go somewhere, I mean, you end up getting very clued into to that idea that you have to find fuel. So you start making your route up around that.
But it's self-sovereignty. Nobody's going to help you at that point. Well, they will if you wait long enough. But you really do need to take responsibility for your own
survival.
Your
best, what was your best experience on? Is this... So, when my before I ask you how it ended, let's say, what was your best experience?
Yeah, there's so many. The lockdown in Chile was probably one of the highlights of that trip, just because it forced us to stop. because we were moving fairly quickly, every few days, sometimes every day. And the fact that we were physically stopped from moving out of that compound, if you like, for 4 months, it just put us into like another layer of relaxation, I guess. Very present with the kids and the other families that we were with. So yeah, I'd say that probably.
When you said you found that place, it was an American and a local. Was that on some kind of app where you can find places to stay?
Exactly. Yeah. So there's a couple of different ones. Europe has like a Part for Night, it's called. There's iOverlander, which is more kind of US centric, well, North the America centric. So yeah, you find these places, and normally you pay a very small fee, or if it's a farm, then you know, you could buy something from the farm shop and park in the car park or park in the field or whatever.
And how many of you were stuck at that farm?
Total, we were, well, three families, so 12 of us. We had two kids.
Are you still in touch with them now?
Yeah, we are. Yeah.
I was going to say, that must have been an amazing experience.
It really was.
Yeah. Wow. So what happened when that place opened up then, or when Chile opened back up?
Well, we saw that there was no near-term chance of moving the truck out. And so at that point, the British government put on a repatriation flight. And so we really did think long and hard about whether to take that flight back. Ultimately, we ended up taking the flight, and we were able to ship the truck back as well. It took slightly longer to get back, but that was fun because we had to get the paperwork from the embassies, and then we had to drive through all of the military checkpoints to get to the port, and we're driving this big truck that looks like a army vehicle and stuff. So yeah, getting a few funny looks. And then yeah, so we dropped the truck and jumped on a repatriation flight back to the UK.
And I mean, had COVID not happened, you would have just carried on, or did you have a plan to come back anyway?
We would have come back. I think the plan was to carry on traveling all the way up the Pan Am up to Canada, effectively.
Wow! So it put a halt to that.
It did, but then we picked it back up. So it was back in the UK the summer where the first restrictions started to lift. So people were coming out for the first time in, you know, 6 months or whatever it had been. So we got to see friends and family in this small window where the world opened up again. And we managed to, I think we were back in the UK for a couple of weeks, and then we escaped back out. We managed to, a friend of ours had just finished overlanding a few months prior to that, and had his truck in Europe at the place where we both got it built. So we managed to use his for that summer, and we just kind of went around the Alps, which was great because there was no tourists around whatsoever. So, you know, wild camping throughout Switzerland and stuff, which you really can't do in the height of summer normally. And we did that until our truck arrived back in the Netherlands, and then we picked it up, and then we just said, right, okay, where's the most free part of Europe? So we headed east, and we went to the Balkans, Albania, Romania, Bulgaria, and then traveled all through Turkey. So we spent 3 months in Turkey, and went all the way out east to the Syrian border, and then back through Europe again.
How long did that take?
What was that? Probably another year. So we're on the road 2.5 years total. Yeah.
Why did you come home in the end then?
Great question. We got a little tired. I think if you're on the road full time, like we were four people in a small box, effectively. So you do get a bit of lethargy. So we decided to come back and take a rest. But I don't think we've particularly settled back into society, should we say.
Where's the Bitcoin part come into this? At what point? I can't really, I'm just trying to think about it, because what we'll get onto in a minute is you basically, it was about a year and a half ago you started BTC Maps.
Yeah, about a year and a half.
Yeah, ago. Yeah. You started an app which has become phenomenally successful, especially mm-hmm. within the Bitcoin community, which is basically a way to find merchants who accept Bitcoin all around the world, called BTC Map. But where did the Bitcoin journey of yours start?
So it came through the homeschool route. So, like everyone, I'd looked at it, you know, back in the day and dismissed it, didn't put the work in. And then we were using an online schooling platform called Cubio. It was called Galileo back then, which is an excellent platform that enables kids to kind of do stuff together online. And there's various different classes they can take and stuff. And it was actually our good friend Dan Prince, who I obviously didn't know at that time, but Dan's son Sam and my son Sam became best buddies on this online platform. And so we'd started hanging out, doing some of the kind of spaces, Twitter spaces or whatever it was back then, around home education. And Dan was very vocal on that side of things. And of course, he's very vocal on the Bitcoin side of things. So it was actually when we just got home, finished traveling. Dan's been in my ear about this Bitcoin stuff. And I suddenly had some time because life on the road is busy. You know, thinking about where we're eating, how we're fueling, you know, the kids. So everyone thought it was a nice holiday, but it was full on. So got home, and there's a tweet actually. I said, amazing experience, blah, blah, blah. I wonder what's next, dot, dot, dot. Well, it turns out the thing that was next was Bitcoin. So I had some time and just started reading about Bitcoin. So read the white paper to start with, and then just bombarding Dan with questions for 48 hours or so. But because of my background in software and because of my background in physics and thermodynamics and time and all that good stuff, and I'd always had an interest in politics and economics and all that kind of stuff. So for me, Bitcoin was this perfect storm of all of those things coming together. And I remember that first week was just hell, really. It was painful. I think most people take, I don't know, months or perhaps even years. And I suppose if you count when I first interacted with Bitcoin, it did take me years. But when I actually sat down and looked at this thing, my wife thought I was gone insane. And most of my friends still think I'm insane, but I kind of lost the plot for a couple of weeks. Like, you know, wasn't sleeping, wasn't eating, was reading, you know, a book a day, and you know, reading GG's Bitcoin is Time on day four, and just basically having your entire mind. Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. He always did have a mental breakdown when he discovered Bitcoin.
I did.
He's told that story to me before. Yeah, he thought it was going to end up in a white, you know, like the guys in white suits were going to come and get him.
Yeah, and I did. It was terrifying.
Really?
Yeah, it was.
How so?
Well, it just turns your mind inside out. Everything you ever thought you knew is.
What was the main thing then? Which part of your whole life got turned upside down the most?
Well, understanding what money is. And how when we have distorted money, that leads to distorted everything, you know, in terms of food and, you know, wars and all of that stuff. You kind of get angry because, you know, you've been lied to, and almost angry at yourself because you haven't put the work in to properly understand the environment you exist in.
Why would you, though? I mean, this is the thing.
Well, you should. You should.
Yeah, right? But back in the 20 years ago, that wasn't a thought that many people had. Mm. It's interesting.
Well, it ties back into the education system, and critical thinking is not something that we're good at creating in an industrial education system. So, there was that side of it, but because of the physics background, and one of the things that when I started digging into it, the people in the space, there's a lot of physicists in Bitcoin. I don't know if you noticed, you know, Gigi and Calais and others. And we start from first principles thinking most of the time. And so, you know, when you start to realize that, you know, Bitcoin is a clock, it has its own time. We have Newtonian time and relativistic time, and now we have the time chain, and this is Bitcoin time, and it's an entirely different measure of time. And so, yeah, it just hit me from all angles.
The Bitcoin time thing, right? And I didn't get this for a long time, and I probably still don't get it, so correct me if I'm wrong. But the thing that bugged me about it was it wasn't uniform in the traditional sense. Obviously, it's uniform if you're talking about... I mean, what you're saying is each block is like a tick of the clock. Is that right?
Yes. Time is just a measurement system, and we're just using a different system to measure time. So, yeah, without wanting to get like super deep, unless you want to go there, we can.
No thin boy stuff, mate. I've been talking that all morning. Let's keep it let's keep it nice and easy, lemon squeezy.
The thing is the only thing we really know about time is its direction. Okay, Einstein showed that time is relative. We have different perspectives on time depending on how fast we're traveling. Effectively, so time is relative. It is not absolute. The only thing we really know is entropy increases over time. So that's the level of disorder increases. And that's how we know how time is moving forward. So if I put an ice cube down on the table here, you will know if you're watching a video of that play backwards, that that video is being played backwards because the entropy is decreasing as it, you know, goes backwards and then back up into the ice cube. So all we really know, and it's the second law of thermodynamics, entropy increases. Pretty simple. And that's what we have with Bitcoin, really, on the time chain, is we have a certain past because we know a set of blocks have been mined in a given order, and we have an uncertain future because we don't know what blocks are going to be mined next, and it's all random, effectively. And so there's some very deep links with how that links to entropy and the passage of time in the real world. So it's just a different type of clock.
Oh, right. But that clock, as far as like when we use a traditional clock and I say I'll see you in 10 minutes.
Yeah, it's absolutely useless for like catching a train.
Yeah.
But it's very useful if you want, if the order of things matters more than the precision of when a thing happens.
Right. And that's, explain that then. So when does the order of things matter
more? When you want to have a global decentralized ledger, because if you're basically doing additions on a ledger and subtractions on a ledger, then the only thing that matters is they're done in order.
So I can see where my stumbling block is. It's because for me, time is a very specific thing. Like it's a clock, basically. Mm-hmm. So you're defining time a certain way. And then saying, yeah, a clock is time, but so is the time chain, basically.
Yeah, it's just a different version of time.
Yeah. I've never had that one explained to me before. Thanks, mate. I kind of get that now. I was always thinking, yeah, Bitcoin is time, cool, but what happens when I want to meet you in 10 minutes?
Oh,
it might be 8 minutes or 12 minutes.
It's a terrible clock for day-to-day stuff. It's a very good clock if you want to run a decentralized ledger.
Right, okay, cool.
But so, this was me on day three, which is why I nearly had a mental breakdown. So.
But obviously the self-sovereign side of it must have resonated pretty hard as well.
It did. And I think freedom compounds, doesn't it? It's like a ratchet. Like, it's very hard. Freedoms are won and defended. And, you know, you try not to have less freedom. And so given the freedom of travel we'd had with the truck and the freedom that we'd had with education, self-education, homeschooling, and the benefits we saw in how quickly the kids were picking up different areas with much less effort. You know, we weren't doing 6 hours a day of education, for example. And so, yeah, that just compounded on the top of those two things, really. So that was my entry drug, was travel and homeschool. And you know, people come into Bitcoin from macro or from computer science, but I came from it from probably the most unexpected place, given my background. You'd think I would have come into it from the computer science or the economic side of things. So.
I was just thinking, actually, because... You know what seasteading is, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there a comparison to be made with something like landsteading? Do you get, when you drive around in a truck like you were doing, do you have these kind of, you've obviously got an online network that you use. you know, but are you hooking up with the same people or in the same places? Are there places where those guys hook up and, you know?
Yeah, not to the same degree as the seasteading stuff. There probably is. But when we were doing that, we weren't kind of plugged into that sort of side of the network, I guess. It'd be interesting to go dig into that to see.
Well, it would make sense. It would, yeah. I mean, most people think of, like I say, now it's van life. If you put the van life hashtag on YouTube or on Instagram, there's thousands of people doing it. I'm not quite sure how many of them are really doing it.
No, that's the Instagram crew, right? So, yeah, they're probably doing it for the likes quite a lot of the time as opposed to...
But what it does show, though, is that it's massive. It's the same with people that now sail boats around the world.
Yeah.
You know, like five years ago, I don't remember being able to see vlogs of people sailing around the world.
No.
But now they're just, I don't know, it's taken off.
Yeah. Well, there's the Satoshi boat project. I don't know if you follow that guy.
Wasn't that a complete disaster, though, or something?
He did have a problem with his boat. I think he got some storm damage or whatever. Is that what you're referring to?
No, I thought, maybe I'm getting this wrong. I thought, well, tell me what it is.
He's just sailing around the boat with a massive...
Sailing around the world?
Around the world, yeah, in his yacht with a massive Bitcoin sail.
And are people living on the yacht or just here?
He's living on the yacht, yeah.
So he's just being self-sovereign.
Mm-hmm.
Has he got, what flags he got? Do you know?
I do not know where it's registered now.
Yeah, because that's the one advantage to seasteading that landsteading, if it was called, wouldn't have.
Yeah, because effectively you're always on some sovereign nation's land. Yeah.
I wonder, well, I mean, maybe. No, you can't fix that. You can't really fix that because when you enter someone's border, that's it. It doesn't matter what flag you fly unless you're an embassy.
No.
And you ain't going to get that permission.
No, we've had a fair share of shakedowns on borders and stuff like that as you travel through and... Yeah, I mean, them's the rules, right? So.
Yeah. Okay, let's get back to BTC Maps. I presume the idea to start that came from you wanting to spend Bitcoin.
It did. So I kind of got out of my mental state and then went to Baltic Honey Badger, Riga, 21, so...
Was that the year I saw you there?
Did we meet there? We maybe did.
Everyone was flying around on scooters.
Correct. Yeah, that's where we first met.
Was it?
Yeah.
Right, I remember that.
Yeah.
That was crazy.
Yeah. One of the guys fell off. And
yeah, someone nearly died. But anyway, we won't mention who it was.
Yeah, yeah. So that was my first Bitcoin conference.
Was it?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I met you before that because... I think we met somewhere in the UK, I think.
Nope, did not. I remember it. I remember it.
Blimey.
Yeah. And I was trying to find places to spend sats in Riga prior to going. And, you know, there was a couple of crappy websites that were kind of shitcoin focused or ATM focused or whatever. There was nothing that was very good and certainly not a Bitcoin specific thing built by Bitcoiners. And so I pulled together a few people. Somebody was already working. One of the co-founders was working on an Android app that was available at that time. And that was using OpenStreetMaps as kind of like a geographic database layer below it. But I hadn't got much traction. And the data in OSM was awful as well. There was a lot of crap in there. Basically from the block size wars, because the big blockers were all kind of on the merchant adoption sort of theme. It wasn't a great situation. I got involved. I put a couple of tweets out. We very quickly got some other contributors at the conference, actually. So there was a designer out in Japan, Carnage, who's doing a lot of work on Nostra now. Web dev from Canada, Second Light, who said, yeah, I'd love to help. He'd previously worked on Albi and Geyser and some other things. And then Igor, Russian dude living in Thailand, who's done a lot of the back-end work and some of the mobile development as well. So yeah, very quickly over that period, we got the first designs of what is now BTC Map done in Riga. And they're fairly quickly executed on the back of that to develop the web app. We now have iOS apps and an enhanced Android app as well.
Yeah. And I think it's actually now one of the core apps within the Bitcoin space, isn't it?
There's a lot of love for it. It's a well-loved project.
I think I sent you a message a few months ago where I saw it on something. I saw it on the TV or something. Like, I was like, mate, do you realize? Or like, you know, very well-known people talking about it.
Yeah, it gets a lot of mentions because it's useful, right?
I mean, yeah, it is.
Yeah. And it just takes a lot of work. So now we've got 10.5, maybe close to 11,000 merchants that are registered on there, most of which have been recently verified. It depends where you are in the world. Different regions have different levels of verification. But it's just an endless task.
Have you got any like inside info on Bitcoin adoption then, according to you?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a good metric for Bitcoin adoption, isn't it?
Oh, I always say there's only two things that matter. It's the hash rate and the merchant adoption rate. So ignore everything else. Like the price is irrelevant.
Yeah. Come on then. Tell us then. Is the adoption mooning?
It's not hockey stick and it's not like the hash rate. But it is slow and steady up. Yeah, up and to the right. So we actually, on the website, have a dashboard page. So all of the data is open and available for everyone to see. So yeah, it's steady, linear adoption right now. I have seen, and I've not checked the numbers, but in the last few weeks, there's just been a lot of activity. And I don't know what's fueling that.
Trump?
It's from all over the world.
But he is all over the world, isn't he? Let's face it.
Yeah, but I'm not sure he's driving adoption in, I don't know, Austria or something.
Why would it be then? All across the world, all of a sudden, lots of things are popping up.
Yeah, and I've not looked at the actual numbers, but just, you know, briefly looking at some activity that, you know, every day we see, you know, new merchants being added, it feels like there's a bit of a groundswell of adoption happening.
Go on then. What do you reckon?
I don't know why. Ultimately, you know, it's because it's better, right? So as more people understand, I mean, you don't even have to be orange pilled to be a merchant. So, you know, if you accept Bitcoin, even if it's instantly converted to fiat and hit your bank account, as a merchant, you can do that for lower fees than Visa or MasterCard, and you can be instantly settled in fiat into your bank account. You know, within a few seconds or whatever, with no chargebacks, without having to wait 3 weeks for Visa to maybe pay you. So like, it's just technically superior, it's cheaper, and Bitcoiners are absolutely psychopaths and will drive an hour to a barber if they can pay in Bitcoin. And so people, even like I say, they're not orange pilled, like there's a really good business case there to say it's cheaper and faster and you're going to get more customers.
It is a no-brainer.
It's a no-brainer.
And the software to accept Bitcoin is free, essentially, on the whole, isn't it?
It is free. You know, there are fees. I mean, if you want to roll it yourself in a fully self-sovereign way, then you can do it for almost free. You know, there are Lightning service providers that can help you and charge you very little to do so. And now we've got some great solutions like Musket, the guys in the UK that have got this combined point of sale system that does fiat and Bitcoin, which is great for, you know, training staff, especially if you've got bigger sort of retail operations.
I went to the conference today the first time. I did a quick go around or looking at all the new products, and there's a lot of point of sale people there, aren't there?
Yeah, a lot of merchant stuff. Yeah.
And what's interesting is, because when you travel around the world, like I'd arrive in a country and when I discover someone accepting Bitcoin, the point of sale is like a company I've never heard of before in my life, right? And it's really interesting because if you are creating those point of sale things and you get lucky and you get your foot in the door in a country, you can become the point of sale software, like over a few short period of time.
It's not a monopolistic or duopoly that we have with, you know, Visa, MasterCard. It's a free market.
What are the hotspots in the world currently then?
We've seen an uptick in Argentina recently, actually. Maybe that's a Malay thing. We're also seeing Brazil consistently, actually, over the last 12 months or so. And here in the Czech Republic. So I think, well, Prague's certainly number one as a community on the BTC map leaderboard in terms of number of merchants. And I think the Czech Republic is the top country as well.
It's funny, isn't it? It's the center of the, you know, like you look at how many companies, Bitcoin companies came out of Prague.
Yeah.
And do you know what Vexel is?
Yeah.
So active here. Like I spoke to Leia a couple of days ago and it's turned into a marketplace for everything. It's incredible.
They've got a long history of freedom and individual ism here, I think.
Yeah, but Bitcoin specifically. I mean, a lot of countries in this neck of the woods have been through their fair share of like breaking free, but somehow Czech Republic.
Yeah.
So what about, talk to me some other parts of the world. Where are we lacking in Bitcoin adoption?
China's pretty...
can they even get on it though? That's the thing.
Certainly probably wouldn't put myself on a map if I did accept Bitcoin.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. But I mean, even log into the website probably. There's probably a firewall in the way. But.
Yeah. I mean, Europe's fairly healthy. So we've seen good adoption here in the Czech Republic. Italy, particularly Northern Italy, is very good. There's some OG Bitcoin communities there.
Is that where. What's that place, the town that became a bit of a Bitcoin center in Italy?
Lugano.
Yeah, that's not right there, is it?
Well, that's further north up in the lakes. That's also really good adoption levels with all the stuff being done by, you know, Plan B Network and Tether and stuff. But OG communities, I think it's Bitcoin Valley, a bit further south. Netherlands is pretty good. Another very early adoption place is Arnhem, Bitcoin City Arnhem. So they just hosted Adopting Bitcoin Arnhem.
So Arnhem as in... So Arnhem in the Netherlands.
Yeah, and they've been bootstrapping that circular economy since 2013. So they've been around a while. So that was a great conference recently, and they've got good levels of adoption there. There's this marketplace, like food marketplace, where there's, you know, bar in the middle and you've got all the different vendors around the outside. And through that conference, all of the vendors got onboarded to Bitcoin. And that is, like I said, that's not orange pilling all of those merchants. That's like, they want my Bitcoin. They're actually going to accept it in fiat, but, you know, they want my custom. So that was great to see. So I think there's, I don't know, 10 merchants within just that food hall that are accepting Bitcoin now.
How's El Salvador looking?
It's looking good. There are hotspots. Obviously, you've got Zante down on Bitcoin Beach, guys. Berlin. I don't know if you've heard of Berlin up in the mountains.
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
It's that, what's his name? He's always tweeting about it. The guy with the short hair and his body.
Who runs it? Nicky and... Nicky and James. Mm. Yeah, they live there. That's a great community. So I think they've got like, I don't know, I want to say 150 merchants or so. But that is a proper like bootstrapped local economy. Those sats are staying within Berlin. And I had the pleasure of going up there just before adopting Bitcoin in El Salvador last year. And it was kind of before they got famous. So we just got in just before the conference, which really elevated their profile. But of course, because we're seeing the data on the map, we're like, what the hell is this place and what's going on there? So we went up to go see them ahead of the conference, and it was just a wonderful experience.
What about the rest of Central America, in particular Mexico? Because when we were in Mexico, there seemed to be like a lot of chatter about Mexico becoming somewhere where Bitcoin was really going to take off, but it didn't seem like it happened.
There is adoption there for sure. It's not kind of going crazy that we can see right now. There are some retail chains that are adopting Bitcoin because their founder is a Bitcoiner. So you get quite a lot of volume there in terms of number of places. Guatemala's pretty good. You've got Bitcoin Lake. In fact, both sides of, I forget the lake name now, but both sides, you've got communities, Bitcoin, the circular economy is there. And Costa Rica is really really high up on adoption as well.
Any surprising ones that we won't have heard of before that you've just, because you'll notice them as they, before anyone else probably. Excuse me.
You know. Yeah, I think we covered the main ones. I don't think there's any, what I'd say, surprising.
There's a few
ones.
In Africa, right?
Yeah, so down South Africa is where the bulk of those are. So you've got a few economies down there, like Ekati, obviously, and Bitcoin Witstand, which is just north of there, who currently have the most merchants per capita in the world. So I think it's a village of, I don't know, 200-300 people, but they've got 20-30 merchants or something like that. So yeah, they've currently got the crown as the most densely populated one per capita. And then you've got, you know, other bubbles throughout sort of Africa, over the continent. I think we've probably covered the main ones.
All right then, so before we wrap it up, what's the manifesto in order for Bitcoin to continue to, what's the word, excel? Like, obviously you're into merchant adoption.
Yeah, it just needs to be normalized, right? So the stated mission of BTC Map is to become irrelevant, because when you don't need a map to find BTC to spend Bitcoin, then we've won, because you can use it everywhere. You don't need a map to, where can I spend my dollars, right?
Yeah, but by then you'll be doing like 20% off if you come here, and 30% off.
Yeah.
I mean, but, it'll be a good business.
Well, we'll just become map.com at that point, I guess.
Yeah, right. Or like, you might be, yeah.
Yeah.
But once you've got that infrastructure, I mean, there's so many ways you could evolve that in the future, right?
Yeah, and there's some really interesting use cases that we're currently exploring, particularly with Nostr as well. So I don't know if you've covered Nostr on this pod.
Not yet, pod, no.
But it's one for another day maybe, but...
No. Decentralized social media network, basically.
It's bigger than that. So it's self-sovereign digital identity. Bitcoin is to money as Nostr is to identity, effectively. So never before have, well, arguably with PGP, but really what Nostr enables you to do is create your own digital identity that you own. Nobody else owns that. So, you know, your Facebook profile, Zuckerberg owns. Your Instagram profile, well, I think Zuckerberg owns as well. Right? But anyway, you get the point. Yeah. And even your identity in terms of your passport or your driver's license, that's government issued. It's not yours. You know, they've given you that identity. So what we now have with Nostr is the ability to have a self-sovereign identity and associate that identity in the digital realm with other Nostr key pairs, Nostr identities. And that enables us to have a social graph that we own as well. So with Nostr, that means I can use one application A, and then I can also use application B using the same self-sovereign identity and my social graph, which comes with me wherever I go. So it's kind of like how the web was supposed to be, and how it was actually, you know, in the 90s. And we've just lost our way, effectively. So yeah, that was the TLDR on Nostr. And although the social media use case is the one that people are, you know, more familiar with now in terms of like Twitter clones and all that kind of stuff, Nostr's like much bigger than that. Orders of magnitude more significant than that. And that enables some really interesting use cases. So what you can now do with BTC Map, for example, is, or what you can do, or could do in the future when we get to it, is merchant reviews. So that verifiable merchant reviews. So if I'm going to a coffee shop, and I can use my identity in my social network, my social graph, to weight the reviews against that merchant. So if you like it, and I know that we like the same things roughly because I know you in the real world, then that's going to be, you know, a place I want to go.
That's what I mean, though. In the future, if you said, you know, the plan is to not need to use BTC Map, mm-hmm. I don't think it will. I think by that point, it'll be a layer that's highly usable.
Yeah.
Really. Yeah. I mean...
And Anosta is the kind of protocol that yeah. enables us to open that out into a load of other use cases.
So you're literally going to connect... You're going to connect it to Nosta. That's not the right way to describe it.
We're going to use the Nosta protocol to enable people to bring their self-sovereign digital identities and use those with BTC Map and use those with, you know, Primal as a social app or Wavelake as a Spotify killer, and you know, all your models are destroyed.
Brilliant. So before we go then, you got any travels planned in the truck?
Yep. So we're going to go to Norway this summer. So we've got a Bitcoin meetup actually in the UK that we're going to in a few weeks' time. Bitcoin are up in the Welsh.
I know it well. Yep. Bitcoin Beach Retreat.
Bitcoin Beach Retreat. Shout out to those guys. So yeah, we're heading there. And then actually straight from there, I'll be driving up to Norway. And with the family, so we'll spend, 6 weeks or so driving around Norway and, yeah.
Nice.
Having fun.
Thanks for coming in. Cool talking to you, and good luck with BTC Maps. I think it's a phenomenal project.
Cheers, mate. Thanks for having me.